Have you ever asked yourself what QAnon is? Have you ever wondered why some people think NASA faked the moon landings? Or what links anti-Semitism to flat earth theory? Well, look no further, because this podcast series is here to help demystify the chaos. Hello, and welcome to Defining Conspiracism, with me, your host, Oz Katterjee, where we will be going on a journey with Jewish News UK to the heart of modern conspiracy theories and their proliferation across the world. Joining us on this episode are Gemma Levine, Deputy Director of the anti-fascist advocacy group Hope Not Hate, Lord Winston, Emeritus Professor of Fertility Studies at Imperial College London, the writer and comedian David Baddiel, and writer and journalist and presenter of the Finding Q podcast, Nikki Wolfe.
Gemma, thanks so much for joining us on the show. I was wondering if you could give us a little primer on what conspiracy theories are.
Sure. Conspiracy theories are an attempt to explain significant events and circumstances as the malevolent acts of the secret and the powerful, whether that's individuals or groups. Conspiracy theories flourish in times of crisis when people feel threatened, uncertain, and insecure. And we have looked at research which suggests that people are drawn into conspiracy theories when important psychological needs are not being met. So during the pandemic, we've seen a massive uptick in people engaging with and getting drawn into deeper and deeper levels of conspiracy theory.
Do you think as well, like there's a, you know, we're in a weird situation with the pandemic, so people aren't out, you know, necessarily buying newspapers or walking past shop windows with TV screens on. All of their information is being fed to them directly through social media right now, which kind of, you know, we don't have the necessarily the filters or the education to spot the difference between real legitimate sources of information and less credible ones.
Yeah, I think there's two factors to this. First of all, social media platforms, obviously, that the way information is represented on social media lacks nuance and lacks depth, but also lacks counter arguments. So if you're sitting in the pub and someone says something a bit wacky, there'll be somebody else to counterbalance that. Whereas if once you're online, you can be watching stuff that's fed to you as truth, which could be either misinformation or really kind of like actively trying to take you down a false narrative. And obviously at Hope Not Hate, we see that a lot with the far right, the manipulation of conspiracy theory in order to take people further into a far right way of thinking.
So on your website on Hope Not Hate, there's a useful little introduction to conspiracy theories called Conspiracy Theories, The Danger and the Appeal. And there's a Michael Barkin quote that I quite like that sort of gives us a really good definition. It says, conspiracy belief is the belief that an organization made up of individuals or groups was or is acting covertly to achieve some malevolent end. Do all conspiracies have this idea that there's a malevolent, you know, structure to them, a malevolent force behind them, Gemma?
I don't think that every single conspiracy theory does. The problem is that you can start off believing in something that just wants to make sense of something which almost seems comical from the outside, perhaps. But actually, the conspiratorial mindset brings you into a way of thinking where you question everything. So that's why we talk a lot about rabbit holes when we talk about conspiracy theories. Because once you've got that point of thinking, well, if that's not true, you have to then think, well, if somebody's telling me it is true, or if the government or science is telling me that it is true, they are doing that for nefarious reasons. So once you might get drawn into something which just seems like an alternative explanation for something, but if you start thinking about why the mainstream doesn't believe that, then there needs to be some kind of group behind that. And then we get into things like controlling the strings, and we get into anti-Semitism and all the rest of it.
So, David, I'm going to throw to you now. You know, you've spent a lot of your career covering conspiracy theories and discussing them. So if you could give us a little sort of introduction as to how you sort of stumbled into this world of conspiracy theories.
I think it's slight exaggeration to say a lot of my career. I say the last sort of like few years I've dealt with it more. I mean, it sort of comes out to some extent of my life on social media, because social media, I think, is very key to the expansion of conspiracy theory and the conspiratorial mindset. And I think I put on social media a while back, conspiracy theory, how idiots get to feel like intellectuals. And that was sort of a key thing for me. I mean, I did go on to talk about that in stand-up, in the stand-up show that I did, which was a stand-up show about fame, but it ended with a thing where I'd been attacked by David Icke about something. And there was then some pushback on that, whereby people pictured me as a lizard. Lots and lots of people did lots and lots of pictures of me as a lizard as a way of pushing back against David Icke, which was funny. And we can talk about the ways in which you can combat conspiracy theory, which is innately absurd, perhaps later on. But to go back to the idiots get to feel like intellectuals thing, I mean, Gemma was talking about this to some extent. It's deeply reassuring, conspiracy theory, I think. That's its real attraction, is that people who don't and aren't able to handle the random sort of atomic complexity of the world, the fact that the world, things happen in the world mainly in a chaotic way, right? Mainly in a way that involves no guiding force or guiding principle. I mean, obviously, there are structures of power in our world. They do exist. And there are, you know, all sorts of narratives that do exist in our world. But essentially, most of the time, the universe is random and accidental. That notion that everything happens for a reason, no, everything happens by accident, and we make reasons out of it. And some people want to make those reasons into kind of Bond films, really. They want very obvious good people, which they're part of, and bad people, which they are bringing down. And so that pantomime thing is reassuring. It's reassuring to think that Jews, or whoever they want it to be, created 9/11, rather than a whole series of, you know, complex geopolitical events led to the creation of Al-Qaeda and they did it. It's easier in a way to imagine that Jews did it. And also, of course, it gives you a weird kind of self-esteem because it's like, well, I have seen this. I and all my mates on conspiracy.org have seen this. And therefore, I am not like all these people who have the wool pulled over their eyes. So like many things now, this has existed always, but social media has really turned the volume up. It offers people a type of specialness. They feel that they have individually noticed something. And that is actually fostered by our current culture. Like, if you're going to talk about vaccines, the way that we've moved away from anti-vaccine to this idea of vaccine hesitancy, I think is about the idea that you have to be allowed your sort of individual take on the world now, however wrong it is.
Nikki, I saw you raising your hand there. I'm going to throw to you. I thought social media, your eyes lit up there. So,
well, actually, it's part of that. But I had sort of almost a sidebar question for Professor Winston based on where we've gone so far, which is something I recently came across in reporting on conspiracies, is this theory of, and I'm going to absolutely butcher the pronunciation of this, but pareidolia, which is a kind of, as I understand it, and I'm sure you've got a better explanation of it, but it's the evolutionary kind of baked in instinct to project patterns onto random things. This idea that randomness is psychologically untenable for humans is sort of there's a genetic basis for that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because I suppose, you know, Homo sapiens has been built through evolution with a very inquiring mind, and you need to try and find a apparently rational explanation, or at least an explanation for something which you can't understand. I think that's the very nature of human consciousness. So I don't think it's terribly surprising that people do dream up things which do seem quite rational, but which can turn out not to have a proof associated with them. I don't think that's at all surprising. Also, I'm not sure I agree about vaccine hesitancy, which David is suggesting, because I think actually you have to look at it from the point of the person who is being vaccinated. The fact is, when you are being vaccinated, you are perfectly well. There's nothing wrong with you. And what you are doing by being vaccinated is potentially taking a risk. And that was certainly true of the measles vaccine, and that was not understood by the Department of Health. And unfortunately, the communication that went out was very top-down, and actually that is a big turn-off for a lot of people. So I think the public engagement has been consistently inadequate with many, many vaccines. And there are all sorts of not unreasonable suppositions about vaccines that people are making a huge profit. Well, actually, in fact, they're not. In fact, vaccines on the whole are not profitable. On the contrary, it costs a huge amount of money to make a single drug. You know, something in the region of $1 billion to produce one product is quite typical, and it's a bit more for a vaccine because you have to give it to a huge number of normal people, which is very different from giving a drug to somebody which, you know, has side effects. But on the other hand, of course, you're already ill, and therefore there's a different. So it's a very different issue here. And I have a lot of sympathy with the idea of a vaccine hesitancy. And I know of a lot of very rational people, many of them medically qualified, who have been hesitant about having a jab.
Gemma, I saw you raising your hand there. So what Robert said there was very interesting, but I don't think it's that uncommon in the fact that he's talking about a fabricated or falsified study. Disinformation in and of itself can turn into conspiracism. Is that not one of the sort of key, you know, entrance points, is disinformation sowing seeds of doubt, which then blossoms into a, you know, a theory with a mind of its own, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think what's really going to make a difference in here, and what we have actually seen with the rollout of the vaccine in the UK, is that trusted messengers make all the difference. And what you mentioned before about a top-down approach was never going to work here. And actually, I think, you know, credit where credit's due, there's been a lot of work to find those trusted messengers, whether those are community leaders, faith leaders. There are communities who have hesitancy in engaging in with the NHS in general, medical system in general. If they've had poor outcomes as a community in terms of experiencing racism or inequality in the medical system, then there's going to be a hesitancy across a community. So the best person to speak to a community that are hesitant is somebody from that community. And I do think that in the rollout, things have got better in that sense. I also think it's that there is some interesting research that we can look at that says that if you're worried about anti-vax, for example, you can actually inoculate people with information by talking to the efficacy of the vaccine and talking around the science before the decision has to be made and before any conspiratorial information is given to people who are considering a vaccine. So sometimes you can preempt a conspiracy theory by giving decent information at the get-go.
I think the problem with allowing too much room for the idea of vaccine hesitancy, we shouldn't spend the whole time talking about this, but is that I'm on social media a lot, so I see this a lot, and it may be that social media amplifies it more than is necessary. But there's a difference between an idea of a sort of a community that might be feeling that they have been let down by the NHS or don't trust the government or whatever it might be, which has some validity, and also some validity in the idea of, you know, this is an untrusted thing that I don't want to put in my body or whatever. That's got some value as an idea, to what you actually see on social media all the time, which is conspiracy theory, which is people who think the vaccine is created to engineer an experiment to control humanity, right? So there's a big difference between, oh, I'm a bit frightened of this because of various reasons that might be considered to be valid. The grey area between that and the huge amount of people on social media who think it's an active type of human control system is very great. And so you have to be very careful with this sense of like, well, we want to be nice, essentially, to the people who have fears about it for maybe valid reasons, to not let in conspiracy theory. And this actually is something that happens a lot with conspiracy theory, that sort of slightly woolly but maybe valid anxieties create a space in which much more insidious, much more direct and aggressive ideas that are conspiratorial can be let in.
Well, I think I might be able to pivot this away from it quite effectively by saying that anti-vax itself and vaccine hesitancy itself isn't a conspiracy theory. It's a symptom of a conspiracy theory, because people are anti-vax. You know, there's a group of people who are anti-vax because they think it's a US deep state operation. There are people who are anti-vax because they think it's a George Soros-led Jewish cabal conspiracy. There's lots of different conspiracy theories at play, and this is one of the behaviors that a lot of them lead to. And there's a lot of those around. You know, it's not accepting various things from government, not trusting various, you know, ethnic groups. The conspiracy theories are the ideas behind those that lead to those kind of behaviors, right? That's the distinction here.
More broadly speaking, they all kind of factor together in creating a sort of, you know, ecosystem, an information ecosystem, which can have real world harm. Gemma, I thought I might throw to you to talk about some of the work that you do with Hope Not Hate and how how someone can understand how conspiracy theories that might, you know, seem just harmless blogs that someone's reading on the internet, how that might transfer itself into something much more serious.
Obviously, the kind of people who are going to get most involved with conspiracy theories are pretty vulnerable themselves. They are looking for an in-group, and they are usually looking for a sense of superiority against another group, so that, you know, they want to be part of the people who knows the real truth being the conspiracy theory. So if we already know that those people are vulnerable and they're looking for black and white answers, and that they're getting sucked down into these rabbit holes where things are getting more and more extreme, then they're moving into online spaces where people are encouraging people to act on their beliefs. And that's where we see people actually planning acts of terror or planning to attack other groups because they think that they are the perpetrators of the conspiracy. In April and May 2020, in the onset of the pandemic, for example, 77 5G towers were attacked to the UK. Another thing to think about is if you look at some of the recent far-right terrorist attacks, the March 29 Christchurch massacre in New Zealand and the February 2020 attack in Hanoi in Germany, they were both inspired by conspiracy theory. So, you know, from everything from losing friendships right through to mass acts of terror, the potential for harm is very, very real.
We witnessed something recently in America where a large collective of people had become enamored with this conspiracy theory. And we saw an act of violent insurrection on the streets of Washington, D.C. So, Nikki, could you, you know, as someone that's been covering U.S. politics for some time now, can you talk to us about QAnon, Trump supporters, the sort of information ecosystem that they live in, and how we ended up with a situation like January the 6th happening?
QAnon is unbelievably fascinating because it's an emergent property of the internet in that it's kind of a meta conspiracy. It's not a single conspiracy theory. It's something that has almost been able to absorb every new conspiracy theory that it touches and grow the more it does so. So the core of its DNA is stuff like the blood libel is in there, the lizard people is in, the Illuminati is in there, and it grows and grows and grows to the point where at some point it became enmeshed with Trumpism. And when it started to do that, when it picked a political side, the unique thing about the situation you got is that Trump, unlike any, you know, other politician in living memory, saw that and wasn't like, oh, this is kind of weird, we probably shouldn't encourage this, but said, huh, you know, whatever, if they're supporting us, nod and wink to them, let them do what they like. And so you end up with this perfect storm, which is how we got to the January 6th Capitol insurrection. What had happened was, not only did this conspiracy theory tell people that Trump is a savior trying to rescue the world from this global cabal of Satanist pedophiles, but also senior members of the Trump administration had knowingly winked at it. These were people who turned up on the 6th who genuinely believed that they were part of a battle to save the world. And they had had their beliefs confirmed as much as they could do by the US administration. The people who were the targets, not the targets, the players in this conspiracy theory, this worldview, had encouraged it. And the way it grew, the way QAnon started, so QAnon started in this sort of depths of the internet, started on 4chan and then later 8chan. But at some point it jumped the rails. It moved on to Reddit, it moved on crucially to Facebook and YouTube, where it started finding other audiences. So I've spoken to people for whom QAnon arrived in their lives via the, you know, health and wellness community, people for whom it arrived in their lives via not just right-wing politics, but far left-wing politics. You know, it was making outreaches to Bernie Sanders supporters. It just spread. And what I find so interesting about how a conspiracy theory can then turn into a full and all-encompassing conspiracy worldview is that in the pre-internet age, there was kind of a limit. Whereas now,
these things can just have, there's no limiting factor in terms of its spread, unless the big social media companies act to stop it, which they've made cursory moves towards doing, but really have barely slowed its capability to spread. You know, we're seeing as many Facebook groups and YouTube videos popping up as keep getting banned, and the same with Twitter accounts. It can reach a limitless number of people instantaneously, which is something that's never been true before.
David, I wanted to go to you specifically. You've just done a book called Jews Don't Count, and you've discussed how anti-Semitism intersects with conspiracies, and again, how that manifests itself in real-world harm and racism experienced by Jewish people. So I just wondered if you could talk to us about, you know, anti-Semitism is itself and of itself a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I once saw an American comedian, I can't remember his name, which is bad of me, but he began his set by saying, "I blame the Jews, it's quicker that way." And it's a good joke because it illustrates something about conspiracy theory, which is that almost all conspiracy theories have got it's the Jews at their base. It's kind of amazing. Like, I decided to see if that was the case just out of pure interest with flat earthing, right? Because flat earthing is a conspiracy theory. It's obviously wrong, but it's also a conspiracy theory because all conspiracy theories have an enemy, right? They're very rarely just like, this is an idea I have and it's not the mainstream idea. They have an enemy. And flat earth's enemy are those people who think the earth is round, okay? So who created the idea that the earth is round? If you look into flat earthing, it's an anti-Christian idea because it's part of when we started to think that the world was not at the center of the universe. We stopped realizing that it's actually flat. And the people who did that is the Jews, right? Apparently because the Jews were trying to subvert the Christian idea of the earth being at the center of the universe. And it's interesting what Nikki was just saying as well about QAnon. The QAnon began with the Illuminati, the lizards, and the blood libel. Those are all words for Jews, all of them. They just mean Jews. And there is an awful lot of anti-Semitism in QAnon, as far as I understand it. I mean, the idea of it spiraling out of control in the way that other conspiracies may not be allowed to do before. I mean, that's the internet, is that the evil of the conspiracy theory, the villain of the conspiracy theory, has to get more and more extreme so that you get people actually eating babies or whatever it is. But Jews have always occupied that territory for many people, often in an unknowing way. That I talk in the book how, in my opinion, when you see that mural that Mir 1 did that Corbyn supported of Jewish-looking people playing Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor, you have to relate it to very ancient ideas of sort of devils and gargoyles and whatever, sort of in control of the world. And then the key thing, and none of you will be surprised by this, with why the Jews fit into all this, apart from the deep psychology of the other, is that Jews are a minority associated with power. It's an unusual thing for a minority. Most minorities are just low status in the racist mind. They're just sort of vermin or thieving or liars. And Jews are all that. But Jews have also got this other thing whereby they are thieving and subhuman or whatever, and they're also sort of in charge of the world and behind banks and behind governments. They're both subhuman and humanity's puppet masters. And that particular divergence absolutely allows for conspiracy theory because they are evil and non-human and yet in control of humanity.
Robert, anti-Semitism is the oldest conspiracy theory. How do you interpret that?
I don't think I do interpret it at all. I'm not sure what we mean by conspiracy theory, as I sort of kind of implied. Anti-Semitism, yes, is ancient, but I don't think it can be simplified in the way that you're trying to do. I think one of the issues actually probably is genetic. You know, when Homo sapiens was developing 80,000, 70,000 years ago, we would have been living in small tribal groups, according to Robin Dunbar's work in Oxford. Possibly a typical group would be about 150 people. It depends on the size of the human brain. And therefore, if you then encounter somebody who comes from more than about 50 miles away, they are foreign to you. And they are a threat to you too, actually, because of course they would be obviously trying to take over something you've got, i.e. your land. I think it's very likely I can't prove this, but I don't think this is a conspiracy theory. I think it's just a theory that actually, to some extent, racism is built in to human thinking because of that rather primeval response to something which is different from ourselves. And I think to some extent that applies to anti-Semitism, not only, of course, it's much more sophisticated in many ways. But I don't feel, you know, I could go on about anti-Semitism indefinitely and my own response to it, which isn't at all profound. But I think we do have to see that humans do find people who are different from themselves, facially different, or because they've got some kind of deformity, or because they're stronger or bigger, different color hair, whatever it is, from a different area, we do feel a bit suspicious and we look at them with hesitancy. And I think that's probably built into our nature.
I think Gemma, it'd be perfect to throw you in here. Your response to that, obviously, Hope Not Hate deals with, you know, trying to combat racism in and of itself. So this must be something that you probably have given a lot of thought to.
I'm very much kind of called to mind of our education work that we do in schools. We have a whole education unit. And one of the things that we do with students of all ages is introduce the idea of stereotypes before we even talk about prejudice, because the human brain needs stereotypes in order to function. When we stand on the edge of a curb and we see a big truck trundling down the road, it's that bit of our brain which stops us stepping out into the road. The problem is that when we use that bit of our brain to judge people when we meet them, that means we see people as other and as different. And that's where we come into prejudice. So we talk about this with students and we do lots of interactive exercises for them to be able to recognise that in themselves and in their own sort of innate stereotyping and prejudice, so that they can learn to challenge themselves and learn to challenge each other in a school setting. But I think there is an innate part of our brain which does that. It's how we recognise that that then harms our interactions with other people, and specifically does harm to other people, because we assume negative things about people who are different than us.
Nikki, a lot of this stuff is what you focus on, particularly covering social media and technology.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that I agree with Robert that the idea of the quote-unquote what is the oldest conspiracy theory isn't a useful one, because I think there's probably been, you know, from the first time one caveman had something that two others didn't, there'll have been a conspiracy as to why. But there's also kind of an aggregatory effect, in that once an idea happens, once it's around for a matter of 1,000 years, just by dint of the length of its existence, people take that as some kind of proof of its veracity. And I think if we're looking at anti-Semitism as a particular case study, I think the concept of passing is a useful one. And as much as the R group exists, it's not necessarily, which I think when it lends itself to the building of a conspiracy theory like that. But then there's also specific villains who emerge. I mean, in particular, the Rothschilds come up again and again and again as villains, because it's just so easy when there's a family that has what's considered to be, as David, I think, rightly said, a specific kind of power. It's just the easiest thing in the world for the next logical step to be, therefore, I do not have power, they have power, therefore, something funny must be going on there, right? It's that, and they're all understandable logical steps. And so there's a sort of inevitability to the way this plays out. And then the internet comes along and just turbocharges it, as I was saying before, like it's just those steps which have always been there, which have always been part of how humans think, now just happen at light speed. And it's a dangerous combination.
It was really just the use of the word family, that Rothschilds were a powerful family. Rothschild, they possibly are or are not, but the point is Rothschild stands for Jews within conspiracy theory. It's sort of irrelevant, the actual banking status of the individual banking family. It's just a way of a code word for Jews. And indeed, when Mir One, the guy who I referred to before, and that image of Jewish men with money playing Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor, which could be the cover of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, is the conspiracy theory image as far as, you know, the anti-Semitism element of it goes. When he put a Facebook post complaining about the fact that it was taken down after complaints, what he said was, and it's important what he said, is he said, "I see some old white," very important that he said white, "old white Jewish folk have complained about my portrait of their beloved," again, horrible, insinuating Goebbels-like thing to say, "their beloved hashtag Warburg, hashtag Rothschild." And hashtag very important as well, because it means you can click on them on Facebook, click on the word Rothschild and go straight into thousands and thousands and thousands of conspiracy theories, essentially about Jews. But I think the key thing comes back to that idea of power, because the conspiracy theorist, remember, is always the hero. The conspiracy theorist is punching up as far as he, and it's often a he, is concerned, right? And so therefore, the conspiracy theorist has to have spotted something going on in the world that is evil and that is controlling and all the rest of it. So therefore, the object of attack has to be associated with power. And they also have to be associated with otherness. And Jews fit that very, I'm not saying no one else does at all, but Jews do fit that in the mythology of the racism that surrounds Jews better than sort of many other objects of racism.
So this is less of a point and more of a question that just occurred to me from what David was saying. Why is it more attractive to the male psyche than the female psyche? Is there good data on that? Are men more vulnerable to conspiracy theories than women?
I think that comes back to what Gemma was saying about the sort of psychology. When you said something early on about the psychology of the conspiracy theorist, about someone who feels sort of, you know, not that their level of achievement and level of self-esteem in their life is not what it should be. I sort of imagine, and actually this partly comes out, I used to be patron of Calm, which is a charity that tries to help young men with depression and low self-esteem. And they suffer from those things more than women do, in fact, or certainly in terms of like likelihood to get depressed and commit suicide about it. And I think, weirdly, we still live in a culture where men are expected to be heroic. And there's actually very little opportunities for any kind of real heroism in the world. And I think one way the internet has provided men with an idea of heroism is conspiracy theory. Like, I have seen this thing and I will call to arms all the people who haven't realized that the Rothschilds are controlling the world, and thus I will be a hero. And I think there's something, not that no woman would do it, but I think there's something more male about that than female.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are different pollings that show different conspiracy theories appeal to different kinds of people. So if you look at, for example, young women, much more likely to believe conspiracy theories about Princess Diana's death. So it's partly about appeal. But I would say also that, kind of building on what David was saying, is that it's that sense of feeling that your group is underappreciated or under threat. And, you know, if you think about what's happening in the world right now, and we see this in terms of anti-feminism, for example, the idea of men feeling that their space is being taken away from them, their platform is being taken away from them, things which they are entitled to, or were in their mind historically entitled to, are being wrenched away by others. And then, you know, that kind of fits very well into that conspiratorial mindset that somebody is doing this to them.
Dr. Winston, I wanted to throw to you, because, you know, there is a real world harm element here. Not all of these conspiracies have necessarily a real world harm to them. Not all of them necessarily leave the internet. But the pandemic was a sort of perfect storm opportunity for people to take disinformation and create, you know, whatever theory they wanted to. 5G being the cause of deaths, not coronavirus. Vaccinations being chips into your arm from Bill Gates, this sort of thing. So, you know, as a medical professional, how have you encountered conspiracy theories like this, and how detrimental do you think they've been to public health?
Well, I don't think I agree with you. I actually think that you're looking at the pandemic with a very one-sided view. I think the pandemic has shown a huge amount of human altruism as well in people, and I think it's actually uncovered a great deal of good characteristics that we've forgotten. And this has occurred again and again, people going in at great personal risk, including members of my own family, for example, to actually help people who are dying in hospital because they've got this dreadful infection. And I think that that has been something it's very easy to forget, that, you know, that the human empathy actually is a very, very powerful force as well. And I'm not sure that I really want to draw conclusions from the pandemic on that basis. I just feel, you know, that there will always be people who ascribe irrational views about things or things which aren't proven. We all have irrational views. I mean, I have irrational views. I'm sure you do as well. There are things that, you know, we hate quite unreasonably. I mean, I'm really bad at three things. One is I can't stand cheese, probably because I was force-fed cheese when I was a four-year-old during the Second World War. One is that actually I don't like the sound of crunching bone, which is my second massive, horrible fear, which, of course, I first encountered when I was in an operating theatre as a medical student. And my third irrational fear is my fright at going across to the south of London, across the Thames. I find it completely disorientating. And I have to say that these things are, you know, they're irrational, but they're there. And every time I go to the south London, which happens quite often, actually, for various reasons, I feel quite uneasy, which is, it's nothing to do with the people there, I don't think.
I don't know how David feels like about that as a Chelsea fan. I should imagine he's got quite a lot to say on that one.
Gemma,
did you say you're not a Chelsea fan, are you?
God forbid.
I am a Chelsea fan, but I also, the first time I ever went to South London, I got beaten up by some skinheads.
Well, there we are. Proves my point in a sort of way.
Well listen, as I've got family members who work in the NHS, I agree that the pandemic has also proven for us lots of human altruism. But we've seen situations where governments around the world have repressed the figures, the real figures, and disinformation, not necessarily conspiracies themselves, disinformation and the wrong information in people's hands has sort of led to, specifically Nikki, you would know it more from America, that, you know, the spread of the virus was happening more when people weren't following rules that really you would think that everyone would want to follow. Surely it might only be a minority, but when it's something like a virus that can spread between people, that minority can cause harm, especially, you know, where when it's intersecting with QAnon and the far right in America, as it were. So
I think partly it's the incentive structure that's fundamentally broken, right? You're not incentivized to put out accurate information. You're incentivized, and this is across almost all social media platforms, from Twitter to Facebook to YouTube, you're incentivized to put out content that will get engagement. Engagement can be almost anything. It can be anger. And in fact, anger is one of the more lucrative types of engagement. But that means that the people who are putting out the conspiracy theory stuff are getting this enormous feedback that encourages them to do more. The wilder your claims, the more retweets you get, the more YouTube views you get. And those by the platforms are directly monetizable. That's the ecosystem that's so fundamentally broken here, is that there's no incentive to check your facts. And even the concept of checking facts has become suspect. It's become political. If you check facts, that there was this old saying, I can't remember the origin of it, which is that the truth has a well-known liberal bias. that's been flipped on its head by the fact that for the right, giving accurate facts about science is something to be denigrated as a, you know, radical liberal angle. And if you call somebody out for spreading misinformation, suddenly that's cancel culture got wrong.
Yeah, I'll throw back to you, Dr. Winston, you know, on bad science. You know, let's talk about bad science and bad medicine and bad practice, like Andrew Wakefield, for example. what is the lasting impact of something like that, or what could the impact of something like that if it's not properly addressed by the public health system?
The truth is that the public health system has no place because it can't deal with that sort of issue. No, I think that the, you know, the issue of untruth is that it's a very, you know, very serious. You know, there's a there's an ancient rabbinical saying which is in the Talmud, which is widely widely quoted. Is, you know, that when you come to the question of life, the most terrible thing to do is to take a human life, and when you slander somebody, you take three lives. You take the life of the person you're slandering, you actually take your own life, and actually you take the life of the people who listen to the slander. And I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's a it's an interesting aspect, and that's because it spreads. As I think it was Jonathan Sacks who said it was a virus. I mean, I think he was one of the first persons to use that as a virus. Somehow that seems quite redolent now, that word, but he first coined that 25, 30 years ago. And I think, you know, and I think that Andrew Wakefield continues to reverberate, actually. I think there are many examples of misdeeds of this kind by scientists, which have been very difficult because, of course, they get published, they're on record, and it's very, very difficult to refute them. And it leaves a dark stain on science. And sometimes it may be 30, 40, or 50 years before they're, you know, they're corrected. I mean, the classic example I can think of immediately coming to mind is that the idea of Piltdown Man. You remember when an archaeologist back in the 20s mixed up the skull of a human with the jawbone of a higher primate and argued this was the missing link. And for 50, more than 50 years, it really held up the whole of our understanding of human development and evolution. So, I mean, does it matter that it did? Well, perhaps it's not critical because it doesn't really do anybody any harm. But with so many misapplications of drugs or vaccines or other things, it really does matter a great deal, and the misuse of medicines. And unfortunately, there are a number of medicines that get a very bad reputation, sometimes quite unreasonably, because of these sorts of lies. Or, let's say, misrepresentations, because they're not necessarily lies. A classic example, which is one that's been very difficult, has been the apparent risk of blood clotting with the AstraZeneca vaccine. Now, it so happens, of course, that we know that COVID-19 causes huge vascular changes, and a lot of people who are in intensive care have had blood clotting throughout their bodies, and many have died because they've got extensive blood clotting, not just in their lungs, in their heart, but actually in the kidneys and elsewhere. Now, once you start seeing a few dozen people with blood clots as a result of the vaccination, the trouble, of course, is that it takes a very long time to work out whether this is just simply a matter of pure chance because people have blood clots all the time, or whether it's actually statistically significantly more great a risk than it would be in natural life. And these things can't be decided very quickly. But of course, at a time when you're trying to campaign for extensive vaccination, then some countries, like in France, for example, it's been a really big problem to adjust people to the idea of being vaccinated. I understand that, you know, maybe Gemma could tell us, but I think in France, it's something, you know, the coverage is only about 60%. And in Britain, of course, the commonest cause now for people being in hospital infected with the virus is because, although they've been eligible, they haven't been vaccinated.
I'm going to give you the final word, because I want to talk about policy and perceptions and how we can combat things. So I was going to throw to David now to talk about the kind of emotional and cultural impact of this stuff. So we've just heard about the sort of real world impact that it can have, you know, on human life and human society. What about the cultural and emotional impact that conspiracy theories can have? David, I know this is something that you've covered quite closely.
Yeah, before I go into that, in terms of real world consequence, Robert was just talking there about the way in which a sort of misunderstanding or a factual confusion about blood clotting can get out of hand, and people don't understand what it therefore means when they're having the virus as opposed to the illness or whatever. A conspiracy theory that has real world consequences is the Great Replacement Theory.
Yeah.
The Great Replacement Theory is this notion that Jews are secretly masterminding immigration of brown and black people to white countries in order to undermine the white races. That's a very simple way of putting it, more or less covers it, to be honest. And as you may know, in 2018, 11 Jews were killed in Pittsburgh because of that theory. You know, the guy who killed those Jews had just put on Gab, the social media thing Gab, a whole thing about the Great Replacement theory. That synagogue actually had a charity that was helping, I think, Syrian refugees come to America. And because of that, he thought that was Great Replacement. He said, I'm going in. And he went and killed people as a result. And by the way, my book talks about some of the progressive response to that, including Dame Jenny Tong's absolutely disgusting response to that, where within half an hour, she had posted on Facebook something about Netanyahu, which obviously that bloke was not at all interested in. It's nothing to do with the Middle East. He's a far right conspiracy theorist. And so it's difficult to know, you know, the blood clotting thing is not exactly a conspiracy theory, is it? It's like something that just gets out of hand and the truth becomes mystified and people get frightened. And then there's an active, terrible, evil type of disinformation like the Great Replacement Theory, which leads to a terrible real world consequences. And it's difficult to know on a grading system which is like worse, but I would say the Great Replacement Theory is one of the most awful ones. Then beyond that, yeah, you know, you get microaggressions. You get microaggressions, which are all in my book in Jews Don't Count, which are all about people not even thinking that they're microaggressions. One thing I've noticed actually since I've done the book is that one of the things I talk about in the book is the mythology that Jews are rich and that Jews are powerful and Jews are whatever. And quite a few people have said, oh, I didn't realize it was offensive to say that. And offensive isn't quite the right word, and it's what people think of in terms of racism or whatever. But what it is, the mythology that Jews are all those things, is dangerous. Because, of course, people aren't just happy for Jews in this notion, this mythology that they are rich and successful and privileged. They are, or certainly at some level, envious and angry, and they want to take it away from them, this mythological money, as I think in the book I talk about my grandparents who lived in Germany and owned a brick factory, and within a few years that was all gone, as was most of their family. And that comes from the notion that Jews are rich and powerful in some ill-gotten way. And so there's a continuum, to answer your question. I think what can feel like small little microaggressions, small little assumptions about Jews, whatever minority it might be, but let's talk about Jews because I'm talking about them, which can feel to people like, oh, this is just what everyone thinks, isn't it, about Jews or whatever, but can build and build and build to a point where it's very dangerous indeed. And there's no doubt that that takes in conspiracy theory, because at one moment you're saying Jews are rich, and another moment you're saying Jews control all the banking systems in the world.
Gemma, so we're reaching the end of the show. I was wondering you could give us some light at the end of the tunnel. What can we do from a policy perspective, from just like a community perspective, to try and help our fellow, you know, brothers and sisters with these situations and learning to avoid them and spot them and educate them away from conspiracies?
Massive question, quite a multifaceted answer I'm going to try and give. I mean, obviously, at a structural level, at a policy level, we've seen a massive explosion in take-up of conspiracy theories. But I think we have to see that as a symptom as much as a cause of cynical outlook on politics and society and on engaging with society. And we need to do more to make everybody feel that they have a place and that they have a voice that's being listened to and heard. So I think that on the macro level, that's one thing that, you know, we have to take seriously. Why are people feeling disenfranchised? Why are people feeling that they have to go looking for answers and that they don't have a voice is one thing. Social media regulation, social media platforms are never going to do a good enough job themselves. We need legislation. And this is something that, Oz, I'm sure you know, that we've been doing a lot of work on. Even if, so for an example, Nikki was saying about QAnon, obviously it's really, really hard. You can ban something, but it keeps popping up in these. It's just there's so much work needed to do to clear platforms, and legislation is really going to be the only way to do that. The other thing is that we need to talk about young people specifically, I think, because during the lockdown in particular, vulnerable young people have become very quickly radicalized. We spoke earlier about not having that kind of social bounce back of, oh, that's maybe that's not as normal as I thought it was. And young people kind of sitting and going down those rabbit holes. And we're actually just about to launch a project to work with young people on de-radicalization, working with a caseworker and a clinical psychologist. This is really, when you're talking about people who are really deep down the conspiratorial mindset, that is really, really intense work. We have people contacting us. I mean, I have friends contacting me all the time saying, what can we do? I've got somebody in my congregation, or I've got somebody in my extended family, or in my street WhatsApp group who nothing we say is making a difference, and they are losing all their relationships with their family and their friends because they're sure that they're right and the rest of the world is wrong, and they and we can't have the same conversations with them. So we're talking about really, really deep work there. But on a before we get there, we have to do that kind of work to talk about how we think critically, how we absorb information with a critical mindset. And I mean, I really do think we need to start a primary school with this. We're talking about children who are social media is their world, and they need to understand how to read things with nuance and how to question. Obviously, as adults, we have to take that responsibility. We're playing catch up because we've kind of entered this world, which wasn't really ours. I'm not a digital native. We have to play catch up so that we know, you know, just as conspiratorial ideas of question everything, we also need to question everything. We need to question all the information that comes to us via social media and elsewhere, and think critically and question openly. I think that if we do have those kind of difficult questions, conversations with people, it's really, really not helpful to just shut people down and tell them they're wrong, because that just means that they know that they need to go elsewhere to have these conversations with someone who does agree with them. You're not going to get anywhere by saying, you know, you are wrong. We need to ask people why they think those things, where they may have read them, have they read around it, have they, where else might they have seen it, and get them to self-question is much, much more likely to meet with success. But as I say, when somebody is really deep into this space, it is incredibly difficult to get them back. So everything that we can do proactively beforehand to kind of be that buffer, be that inoculation against the mindset is going to be critical now, I think, going forward. And as we come out of the pandemic, we know that a lot of people have really suffered in terms of mental health, in terms of social isolation, and we need to all just be there for each other and check in on people. And yeah, hopefully we'll all come through.
Thank you so much for that, Gemma. Thanks everyone for joining us tonight. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you all for tuning in to Defining Conspiracism with Jewish News UK. I've been your host, Oz Katterjee, and I'd like to thank all our panel guests for their contributions. Hope to see you all on the next show.